Welcome to today's presentation. Before I begin, I have a few notes. The Toronto Comic Arts Festival would like to acknowledge that the land on which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, and the Indigenous peoples that lived on and cared for this land for more than 15,000 years. This territory is covered by the Dish With One Spoon Wampum Belt Treaty, and today Toronto is still home to many Indigenous people across Turtle Island. We acknowledge that settlers on the land directly benefit from the process of colonization. In recognition of our gathering on these lands for TCAF 2019, the festival has made a donation to the Gord Downie and Cheney Wenjack Fund. We look forward to increasing our support and programs for Indigenous creators in the years to come. Programming at TCAF 2019 is sponsored by Seneca College and their Faculty of Communication, Art, and Design. TCAF would also like to thank our presenting sponsors, the Beguiling, Little Island Comics, and the Toronto Public Library. Thanks to our media sponsor, Now Magazine. We also recognize the support of the Canada Council for the Arts, the Ontario Arts Council, and the Toronto Arts Council. Well, it's my break. Pleasure today to introduce Bill Griffith. Bill begins his cartooning career in the underground comic scene, that's comics with an X. He's the co-founder of Arcade with Art Spiegelman. He's the creator of the wonderful Zippy the Pinhead, and his latest graphic novel, Nobody's Fool, is his chronicle of the real-life inspiration behind Zippy. The story begins in Toronto, 1965, at the CNE, the Canadian National Exhibition. So, Bill, let's begin there.
I don't have that slide, so Mark is holding it up for you to see. The book opens with a center spread shot of the sideshow that accompanied the Conklin and Garrett Brothers Circus at the CNE in 1965. So I open the story there. The reason I open it at that point is not revealed until the end of the book, but I can tell you the reason. The reason being the kind of details about Schlitzie's life that I got were from a guy who worked the circus in 1965 at the same time as Schlitzie was performing there in the sideshow. He was the manager of the bumper cars, and he gave me the kind of insight into Schlitzie as a person, as a human being, as opposed to treating him as a sideshow freak only, that I couldn't have gotten otherwise. I couldn't have really done the in-depth kind of book I did about Schlitzie without this man. His name was Wolf Gurkowski. He was born in Sweden, the child of Holocaust survivors who came to Toronto. And he grew up in Toronto. He told me he ran away with the circus in 1965. And I benefited from that escape. He said he was putting off going to college. So he went and worked for the circus for a year. Anyway, so that's the reason the book starts in Toronto. And just to start, the little background of who Schlitzie was. Schlitzie was one of the top 10 sideshow performers of his time, from the 1920s, believe it or not, up until the late 1960s, when the sideshow was kind of withered and dying. He is often given the name Schlitzie, no proof as to that being true. I actually, later you'll see, I consulted a genealogist, and he could not find any specific birth record of Schlitzie. I don't know why he got that name. Possibly his last name was Schlitz. Who knows? He was most likely born to a German Jewish immigrant family in the Bronx in New York in 1901. In consulting the two people who knew him, who are still alive, they told me he had favorite catchphrases. Among them, his favorite was, "You see," which he used constantly, as if to ask for attention. The others were Bapho, and if he liked you, he asked you if you were married. If he liked somebody nearby, he would point to them and ask somebody else, is he married or is she married? He was gender fluid. He did not distinguish between male and female in that sense. He was always billed as a female. Why? According to Ward Hall, his last manager, who is still alive, the reason was it was just weirder to be a female. It was more exotic and more forbidden to have somebody have either a physical or mental disability or a special skill like flame eating or sword swallowing. If they were a female, it was just more titillating to most people. Of course, there's a sexist reason for that, but that's what it was. So he was almost always billed as a female. Although if you got anywhere within 10 feet of him, you could see he had 5 o'clock shadow and he looked very distinctly male. But he wore a muumuu pretty much his whole life. I was told two reasons. One, just to accentuate his femaleness, and two, because he had an adult diaper. Schlitzie had the cognitive abilities of a 4-year-old child. But if you've ever been involved with a 4-year-old child, that's saying a lot. He could communicate, he could have human emotions, he could have appetites, he could have likes, dislikes. He was by no means, he was microcephaly was the condition under which he was born. There's a spectrum for all such conditions, of course. He was a little bit high on the spectrum, he wasn't low on the spectrum. So he could, he could interact with people and communicate. He was almost always billed not only as female, but as not human. So you have to remember, this is the sideshow. In the 1920s, when he debuted at Coney Island, 1921 or 22, people were very gullible. They didn't know where Borneo was. So if you were from Borneo, you might as well be saying you're from Mars. He was often billed as a wild Australian child. That got people to give their nickel. He was billed as the missing link quite often, segueing off of Darwin's theory of evolution that people misinterpreted to believe that we were all descended from apes. So he was exotic. He was supposed to be exotic. I asked different people that I was able to interview what he did when he got on the sideshow stage. And they said he didn't really do much. He was just talked about. So he would appear on the stage with a guy with a little microphone or a bullhorn. By the way, they're not called barkers in sideshows. They're called talkers. The talker would deliver these exaggerated spiels on who Schlitzie was. The weirdest person you'll ever meet, he has a brain the size of a walnut. He eats nothing but swamp grass and banana leaves. And Schlitzie would just sort of sit there sweetly and smile. He did a magic trick in which he handed the deck of cards out over the sideshow stage to the closest person and told them to pick a card, any card. They picked the card. He then said it was the 10 of spades. Every card in Schlitzie's deck was the 10 of spades. He also did some other little magic tricks, but they were all in the vein of that one. He pretended to play the ukulele, and he pretended to play the piano. But the idea was that he would pick it up and make random notes, and that was supposed to be indicative of how weird he was. So it didn't matter that he couldn't play a tune.
Bill, can I ask a question? What accounts for his popularity? You say in the book that he's one of the most popular sideshow performers of that era. What is it, do you think, drew people to him?
Well, aside from his appearance, Schlitzie was about 4'2", very small. He did indeed have a tapered cranium, which they exaggerated by shaving and putting a little tuft of hair at the top. But I think what drew people to Schlitzie was they liked him. I came across memory after memory of how Schlissi would be nice to people, how they would he would mimic their behavior in a nice, kind of sweet, gentle way. So it's a little hard through today's lens to see why Schlissi was as popular as he was, given the fact that we now have so many ways to entertain ourselves, most of which involve not leaving the house. In those days, people went out and got their entertainment outside of the house. And Schlissi was, the sideshow was a primary source for that kind of thing. I think he just appealed to people because he was exotic and yet approachable. He had to be because he was literally one of the top 10 earners in the sideshow business all throughout the decades of his career. Anyway, so I was talking to his manager, this man, Ward Hall, who was now about 90. And I wanted to know what it was like to perform, when Schlissi performed. What was the scene? Could he paint me a picture of the scene? And I had to wait patiently while he did his spiel. He literally, into the phone, he said, "Schlissi the pinhead, with a brain the size of a walnut." And he went on and on about Schlissi as this. He said Schlissi was born to millionaire parents in San Antonio, Texas, who kept him locked in the attic for 20 years. He just made things up, one after the other. So I realized I couldn't stop him. I just had to let him wind down. Once he wound down, I said, "So, Ward, tell me, what did Schlissi like to eat?" He said, "Fried chicken." I said, "What did he not like to eat?" "Yeah, we never could get him to eat salad." Then I said, I was always curious, there must have been people in the audience, in the sideshow audience, who were not kind to him, who tormented him. What would he do? What would Schlissi do? Well, Ward said, if he was being tormented beyond verbal assaults, for instance, teenage boys would throw either lit matches or lit cigarettes at him. When that happened, he would do a kind of a slow burn. He would get down on all fours, crawl to the front of the sideshow stage, and stare at the tormentors and say, in a kind of an animal tone, "You see? You see? You see?" At which point the tormentors would be freaked out, they would leave, and the audience, who were identifying with the tormentors up until then, turned on the tormentors as they left and hissed them. So in effect, this was part of Schlissi's act. The talker would love for this to happen. They couldn't make it happen, but they would really like it to happen, because then Schlissi ended his appearance with a big round of applause, because he had you know, defeated his tormentors. So I thought that was a great insight into Schlissi, because this was not something he was trained to do. He just did it on his own. So I adopted the fly on the wall approach to writing this book. There was only so much that I could be absolutely sure of in my research. I did due diligence. When I came across what I thought was a fact, I would try to corroborate it with at least one or two other sources. But there were plenty of things that I couldn't find. The main, one of the early things I couldn't find was his family life before he went into the sideshow. All I knew is that he was born in the Bronx. He probably was of German Jewish heritage. So I imagined his childhood. And in those days, when a sideshow came to town, in this case it would have been the Coney Island sideshow coming to the Bronx, the manager would go through the various neighborhoods asking around, are there any really weird people living in the area? Anybody with three legs? Anybody with no arms or legs? Anybody with funny-shaped heads? And he probably got a lead, and he came to Schlissi's parents. I do know that Schlissi was sold into the sideshow at about the age of 9. When I say sold, I mean the manager would approach the family, the parents, offering them what he promised would be a weekly check. Very rarely did the check exceed more than 1 week. He then took Schlitzy, this particular manager named Stephen Mills. He took Schlitzy to Coney Island to the Dreamland Circus sideshow. There's no record of Schlitzy performing as a child, so he must have, but I don't have a record of it. So what did his parents think of when this was happening? I decided that his mother would have the normal maternal feelings for her son, but that the father would be money-grubbing. So this I made up. At one point early in the book, I wondered what the mother, Schlitzy's mother, would have thought after this had happened. After all, she was living in the Bronx. Schlitzy was in Coney Island, a couple of streetcar rides away. So I imagine her getting on the streetcar and going into the sideshow and being in the audience and having a cathartic, regretful moment, and bringing Schlitzy a kind of security blanket. So I created this object that I show earlier in the story. It's a Campbell's Soup Kids plate with the Campbell's Soup Kids in the middle of the plate. I made sure this was accurate to 1909, and I have it as something Schlitzy held on to as a little kid. So when he was taken from his family, the plate was left behind. The mother brings him the plate while he's performing in the sideshow. I just wanted to get as much feeling as I could into this scene, and her regret and his fear, torn from his family. There's an aspect of the sideshow that you have to remember, which is it's kind of a surrogate family unto itself. The performers form a kind of family. And there's two levels of the families in sideshow. One is all the sideshow performers who are skilled, sword swallowers, flame eaters, magicians, knife throwers, those kind of people. They're just skilled. Then further into the family are the people who are physically or mentally unusual. Schlitzy clearly fit that mode. He was early on kind of adopted by the bearded lady in the sideshow in Coney Island. And in a way, he was protected by a kind of surrogate family all his life. If Schlitzy had remained in the Bronx, he probably would have been relegated to a room in the apartment. I probably would have rarely come out. There would have been shame attached to him and the family. And I don't imagine he would have had much of a life. He might have died early. In the sideshow, he was exploited, but he didn't know it. And he was sold into this place. He had no say about that. But his default mood was happy. I actually have a microcephalic person in my family through my wife's family. She's 12 years old. And whenever I see her, I think, this is Schlitzy. She is happy, always mimicking people, playful, yes, limited, and needs the care of her parents for the rest of her life. I'm not trying to gloss that over. But everything I've been told about Schlitzy and everything I can see about him in his two film appearances makes me think that this was his default mood, that he was happy most of the time. Not that he couldn't be made unhappy, but that he was basically, he was in a good place by being in the sideshow, ironically. This is the sideshow into which he, not the sideshow, but the circus into which he was first taken. This is Coney Island in 1904. It's obviously an early morning shot before the crowds arrive. And the reason I'm showing it to you is not so much to establish anything about Coney Island, but this photograph I came across about a year ago, after I finished the book, it was taken by my great-grandfather. William Henry Jackson. If you Google William Henry Jackson, you will see thousands of photographs. He was a famous photographer, mostly known for his pictures of the Old West, Old Western United States. But he took this picture. Look at the middle towards the bottom. See a little polka-dotted figure there? Can you see him? there are moments in my life when my jaw has dropped, and this was one of them. Not only is he wearing a little polka-dotted outfit, but either his head is shaved or he's got a fake shaved head. And I don't know. There's a website where you can buy this photograph, and I bought it. It's a beautiful digital print. By the way, the two characters in the back, those are racist Irish stereotypes, walking around like big Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse heads. Irish people at that time were thought of as not quite human by the prevailing Protestant population. So they were objects of ridicule, and that's what they are, those two characters. So the genealogist did his best. He had advanced software that I couldn't have access to. And like I say, it's close but no cigar. He very often, Schlitzie's last name is given as Metz, but that's not likely because Metz was the name of his second manager. He is often given the last name as Surtees, S-U-R-T-E-E-S. And that is correct, but only because he was adopted in 1936 by his manager, George Surtees, at that time.
And in fact was buried under that name, right? Isn't that what's on his gravestone?
Yes, it's on his death certificate. I could not find a birth certificate, but I did find a death certificate. And that's his life. On the death certificate, it says, occupation, sideshow freak, it says on the death certificate. So yeah, I couldn't confirm genealogically. I personally joined various genealogy websites. It's amazing what you can find. And the way to find things really is not through U.S. Census, but through city census records. U.S. Census records are on the tens, and cities are on the fives. So 1915, 1925, things like that. And they're much more complete. They give addresses and people living with the person, and I couldn't find them. Okay, so now we have to at least acknowledge that that I do something, that I've done something for close to 50 years called Zippy the Pinhead. Where did I get that from? I got it from this man. Named, according to legend, named by Charles Dickens on a visit in the 1860s to Barnum's museum in New York City. His real name, and this is slightly, it changes sometimes from source to source, but his real name was William Henry Jackson. Born in 1843 in New Jersey. Okay, my name, and named after my great-grandfather, is William Henry Jackson Griffith. My great-grandfather was born in 1843, but in upstate New York. So they're not the same. This guy's a black man from New Jersey. He spent his entire career with Ringling Brothers from 1864 to 1926. Usually billed as the wild man from Borneo. That was that hair suit he's wearing in that picture. That's what that's all about. But he was an actor. He was not a microcephalic. He was not a pinhead. He just had a tapered head and he was short, but he was an actor. But I thought I should give him a bio and take him for his, just portray him as he was portrayed. These are all drawings taken from publicity shots of Zip the What Is It. And the minute you look at these as photographs especially, you see this is a man being told by the photographer, look strange, look weird. And he's almost like saying, is this weird enough? If I do my head this way, do I look stranger? he's clearly acting. Every visual indication you get from pictures of him, you can see that he was an actor. But he fooled people. His deathbed words supposedly were, "Well, we fooled him for a long time, didn't we?" His sister kind of ended the speculation after he died by saying he was a normal human being. He could speak and act in every sense like a regular person. He was not a microcephalic. So, Mazepi is named after a fake pinhead. But all I really got from Zip the Wit was the name Zippy. The way Schlitzie looked in the original way I saw him, which was in the movie Freaks, in the 1932 Todd Browning movie, that Schlitzie was the model for how I drew Zippy when I first started doing Zippy in 1970. So this is Zippy's first appearance, underground comic called Real Pulp Comics Number 1, which coincidentally was published the same year that Schlitzie died, which I did not know at the time. My only visual source for Schlitzie was a postcard in the possession of a fellow underground cartoonist. And in this opening splash panel, that's, as you can see, that's Schlitzie. That's not Zip the What Is It. Little did I know, I'll have to go for Q&A later. Yeah. Little did I know, I would be doing Zippy for the next 50 years. When I did this, I thought it was a one-shot story. The editor of the Underground Comic was a cartoonist friend of mine named Roger Brand. And when he asked me to do 5 pages, I said, "Do you have any kind of guidelines?" You know, he said, "Yeah, well, why don't you do something like a love triangle with 2 normal people and 1 really weird person?" So this was my really weird person. I like to include Schlitzie into my Zippy strip once in a while, just to give a little background and you know, give a nod to who he is and how important he was to me in the genesis of Zippy. So he pops up once in a while. I like to just correct different myths about him and his name and what he did and what he didn't do. So these are just sort of factual strips that pop up every once in a while in my daily Zippy strip, which I still do 7 days a week. So here's the American Sideshow as it appeared. If you go online to look for reference material, it just comes flowing out, thousands of images. You have to remember, this was a time from the 20s and 30s into the 50s when the entertainment options we have today were not there. So people actually went, like I said, they left their house to be entertained. They went to circuses, they went to the sideshow. The sideshow was always a way to funnel people into the circus. So to go into the circus, you would go through the sideshow lane, and along the way, you would maybe give a quarter here and a quarter there to go into each sideshow tent to see the performance. This is one in, I think, outside of Spokane, Washington. Towards the 50s, sideshows got kind of morphed together with girly shows, which you would call girly shows. Not quite strip acts, but where women scantily clad, although scantily clad in the 50s terms is not the same as today, they would dance, they would do knife throwing. You can see behind the talker there is a woman with a snake. That was a very common sideshow attraction. Attractive woman in a bathing suit with a big boa constrictor hanging around her neck, and the snake would writhe around, and you can draw your conclusions from that. So Schlitzie performed in this venue as well as in the earlier venue. This is Coney Island in the 40s, the World Circus Sideshow. So now we come to the kind of genesis, the real genesis for me of where Zippy comes from, although it took me a long time from this moment until 1970 when I did the first Zippy strip. In 1963, I was going to art school in Brooklyn, New York, Pratt Institute. And I saw in the Student Union building a little ad that said, "Banned since 1932, Freaks, a movie about the circus sideshow." And I noticed that it was showing somewhere in Greenwich Village. I thought, okay, banned since 1932, and it's being shown in a loft in Greenwich Village. Maybe there will be beatniks there. And there were. So I didn't know why I went to this, except for those two reasons. And I did, I went. And I sat there as the film played, and as my molecules were rearranged. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Freaks, but it's an amazing film. Todd Browning, the director, had previously directed Dracula, the Bela Lugosi Dracula, 1931. It was a blockbuster hit. So he was kind of given carte blanche. What do you want to do next, Todd? And he said to Irving Thalberg at MGM, "I want to do this movie about the circus sideshow, and I want all the sideshow performers to be real sideshow performers." And Irving Thalberg said, "Okay, well, we got to get a star attached to this." And they approached Jean Harlow and Myrna Loy, both of whom said, "No way. No way am I going to be associated with disgusting people like this." So, amazingly enough, Thalberg gave a green light to the movie anyway. It got made. And it was immediately panned and taken out of circulation within 6 weeks. Here's Schlitzy in Freaks. He has two scenes. He is shown in the opening sequence just dancing around with one of the sideshow midgets. And later in a little bit longer, much longer actually, scene, 3 or 4 minutes, in which he has a interaction with Frozo the Clown, played by Wallace Ford. And this is what people mostly know Schlitzy from. Here's Schlitzy on the scene. Now, you have to remember, whenever you see Schlitzy being photographed, he's not aware he's being photographed. That face of happiness is because, see it, the beer he's holding? There's 1 inch of beer in that glass. Wardhol said he was given 1 inch of beer per day. And this was like the most happy moment of his day when he got his 1 inch of beer. I said, "Why 1 inch?" He said, "Well, if you let him drink a whole glass, you never know what could happen." Schlitzy tipsy was not something they could control. He would get very crazy. So this is Schlitzy just before he's able to drink his 1 inch of beer. And he's very, very happy. So I came across this still. While I was doing the book, there was an auction of still photographs from Freaks in a New York auction house. Almost all the photographs were taken by either Todd Browning himself or by the official photographer at MGM. So this came up. You can see Schlitzy's diminutive stature here. Todd Browning is tall. He's about 6'1", and Schlitzy is about 4 feet. You can see Todd Browning behind Schlitzy there with his hands on his shoulder. Todd Browning and Schlitzy knew each other. Todd Browning himself performed in sideshows before he became a movie director. By the way, look at the bottom, the man with no arms and legs. That's Prince Randian. And to the left of him is Johnny Eck, who is billed as the half-boy because he was the lower part of his body was missing. They both had long, long sideshow careers. So here's Todd Browning. There he is on the lower left in the climax scene of Freaks, in which the freaks have turned the evil aerialist Cleopatra into a chicken because she plotted to kill Hans, who is portrayed by Harry Earl on the right there. I'll get into that in a minute. So anyway, it's fascinating what Todd Browning, his career before Freaks, I had no idea. He was billed often as a wild man from Borneo in sideshows in blackface. He was a clown. He was a contortionist. He toured the country doing skits based on comics, specifically Mutt and Jeff. I didn't even know this existed. This was a whole wing of, not quite vaudeville, it's just touring performers who would perform the characters in popular comic strips of the teens and 20s. I found out from my syndicate, King Features, that they had authorized a number of these, but a lot of them were unauthorized. So there would just be, you know, there could be a Little Nemo or a Crazy Cat show that was completely unauthorized, illegal, traveling the country. The weirdest thing I uncovered about Todd Browning was his most famous act, in which he would lie down in a 6-inch rectangular ditch in a kind of a tight little suit, have the dirt covered up to level to the ground, a straw attached out of his mouth sticking up out of the dirt, into which he would be fed malted milk balls to see how long he could stay this way. So people would come for hours and stand at the side of this little ditch watching somebody feed malted milk balls into a straw, and to them this was entertaining. He would go on sometimes for 2 days. 2 days. I think his record was 3 days. If any of you remember, I do, back in the 50s, DJs, radio disc jockeys, sometimes would do marathon sessions where they would stay up for day after day. I remember one of them, I think it was Murray the K in New York. He did that in the store window of Macy's department store. So he broadcast from the window of the department store so people could see him. And he just stayed up, probably popping Benzedrine and coffee. And this, once again, this was entertainment, the 50s. But to watch just a straw sticking out of a ditch, it's going pretty far. And then Browning also got his career working as an assistant for D.W. Griffith. So he had a long career before he did Freaks. Okay, so once the Freaks were being shot, I was able to dig up a lot of material. F. Scott Fitzgerald happened to be on the set, in the MGM lot, towards the end of one of his stints there, when Freaks was being filmed, heavily drinking, miserable. One day he goes to lunch in the commissary, and who should sit next to him but Daisy and Violet Hilton, the so-called Siamese twins. They were joined at the hip. He became so disgusted at the sight that he threw up on the spot. And the next day he demanded that all the sideshow freaks eat their lunch outside, which MGM said okay to. Incredible little... You can see Schlitzie there, once again smiling, happy. Prince Randian on the left. It's a nice shot of him. Prince Randian was a 40-something-year-old West Indian man. He spoke 3 languages. As his career went on into the 40s and even into the 50s, he owned a large house in New Jersey and had 3 children, 3 female children.
So we have about 5 minutes to go, Bill. So okay. I don't know if you want to move towards a conclusion or if we want to open it up to
Q&A. I'm not used to being confined to 45 minutes, I guess. Anyway, so there's Schlitzie and his big scene. let me see, I can go. If you read the book, you'll see I actually interpret what Schlitzie is saying in his big scene in Freaks, which if you watch the film seems garbled, but I slowed it the way down and I got a pretty good approximation of what he was really saying. So the movie was released. People didn't just walk out, they ran out. Later I found out that he traveled with the Tom Mix Circus. There was a big dust storm, it destroyed the circus. He saved one of the chimps. At this point, he was managed by George Surtees, who then legally adopted him. The only other film he was ever in was Meet Boston Blackie in 1940. There's a prolonged sideshow scene in which he's just in the background and the talker is spieling on and on about him, but it's a beautiful just portrait of Schlitzie, a quiet portrait of Schlitzie. Believe it or not, in 1962, Schlitzie, after performing in San Francisco, the teenage boys of the Bay Area went into the barber and demanded the Schlitzie haircut. This was corroborated by two newspaper accounts. This really happened. He performed on the same stage as the Beach Boys in 1962 in San Bernardino. He performed on the same stage as the Three Stooges in Toronto in 1966. This man is Wolf Gerkowski. He's the man who gave me all my deep, in-depth ideas of who Schlitzie was. Here he is at the age of 18 when he was working in a circus in Toronto. He carried a copy of Being and Nothingness by Jean-Paul Sartre with him for those 3 months. That gives you a little indication of who he was. So he gave me a nice long interview. There's the hotel where they stayed at in London, Ontario. And, you know, this is in the back of the book where I swing back from the early book started, in, the early pages started in 65, and at the end it goes back to 65 in more detail. With Schlitzie says, Wolf says, Schlitzie seemed to be blissed out to me. If you'd look into his eyes, whatever consciousness he embodied was wide open. There was no good or bad, legal or illegal. There was just demented glee. There's his manager, Ward Hall, saying on his publicity thing, the poor man's Charlie McCarthy. And there he is currently, more or less, on the right. He gave me a lot of detail about Schlitzie's career. Towards in the mid-60s, he traveled in a school bus throughout the United States and Canada. This man became very important. He's Bill Unk's sword swallower and became friends of Schlitzie during their days in the sideshow. And when George Surtees and his wife died within 1 year of each other, Schlitzie was confined by their daughter to the L.A. County Hospital, which could have been a very tragic end for Schlitzie, who went into an almost catatonic state for almost a year in the psych ward, only to be discovered completely serendipitously by Bill Unks, the sword swallower, who had a job as an orderly in the hospital and rescued Schlitzie and brought him out of the hospital and back to the sideshow. Talk about a third act opener. He was then, as he retired, by the way, his last performance, he was introduced on the stage by Ed Sullivan in a indoor circus in L.A. in 1968. He was then given a caretaker, a man named Dick. I couldn't find him any further than that. He lived in L.A. He lived in Santa Monica, on Santa Monica Boulevard, and he frequented the MacArthur Park nearby where he fed the ducks and the pigeons. The local Mexican-American people called him El Ratoncito, the little mouse. And they said to him, when you die, you will go straight to heaven. His last performance was with Dick on Hollywood Boulevard, accompanied by a transistor radio. He would dance, and they would sell postcards for 10 cents. He died on September 24th, 1971. He was buried in an unmarked grave in Queen of Heaven Cemetery in Roland Heights, California. Almost 40 years later, a group of admirers got together and arranged for a proper headstone. I gave him the beer. That's it.
So we didn't have time for a Q&A, but I want everyone to know that you can ask your questions to Bill, because he will be at the Abrams table, and he's around today and tomorrow.
Yeah, after this I'll be at table 113, the Abrams table, around the corner, signing copies of my new book, if anybody is interested. Anybody have any questions?
Wow.
Yeah.
I apologize. I have allergies. That's why.
Okay.
But I do have a question. Microcephalus, I was under the impression, obviously wrongly, that it shortens somebody's life.
It can, but not always. Like with all birth defects, there's a spectrum.
There's a spectrum.
And he lived to be 70 years old.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Maybe one last question and then we'll wrap it up. Yes, sir, at the back.
Hey, so since there are real people with microcephaly and people like Schmitty's, and you write Sidney the Pinhead, what do you do to sort of balance your respect for those people without engaging in further exploitation of them in your Sidney the Pinhead? Are you ever concerned about that?
I endeavor to make them human. That's all I do.
Okay.
Yeah. And if anybody is upset or offended, I just I say I'm sorry. But my purpose is to make them human and sympathetic. Anybody else? Okay. Yeah. Chester.
You still do a college trip 7 days a week?
Yeah.
And how are you able to do that?
Well, Mark has my other graphic novel that came out a few years before. That came out in 2015, I guess. And that was percolating on the back of my brain for decades. I could tell you in great detail how it happened, but it was a visit with my uncle, and one thing led to another, and that book got triggered. Once I finished it, after a couple of months, where I thought, now I can relax, because that meant working 7 days a week for 3 years. After 2 months, I felt the empty nest syndrome, the empty graphic novel syndrome, and so I started Schlitzie. With a month after I finished this, I started a third one.
Wow.
It's going to be a graphic biography of Ernie Bushmiller, the creator of Nancy.
Yeah. In fact, what I said to Bill is I think he's doing the best work of his career right now. These last two books are extraordinary. And, but I think we have to get out of the room. So on that note, thank you very much again.